Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Shane Murphy, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Lisa Reynolds, a noted family therapist and marital counselor here in Connecticut. Dr. Reynolds is on the full-time faculty at Iona College in New York and is also on the adjunct faculty at Western Connecticut State University. Thank you very much, Lisa, for taking the time to be part of our interview series, and it's about what we do in the mental health field. So let's just start off with that sort of general question. What is your work week like?
All right, but this is currently a crazy lifestyle, so this isn't really ideal, but I'll tell you what I do because I think that it's important that you know what you could do if you want to have a crazy life for a little while. So I adjunct here, and I have been here for 15 years, since my middle 16 years in the psychology department. And although I have taught many, many, many classes, including personality, never the research and never cognitive, ever. But I have taught personality, abnormal, clinical, but I mainly teach child, adolescent, and adult years here. And I taught lifespan for many years at a community college as well. So that is mainly because I love it. I've been doing it for so long, and I really, my favorite part about teaching, as many of you know who've had me before, is that I like to do exactly this, to tell you all what is good about why we do it, what kind of things you can have as a career and a family, so that if you're considering this field, you really know the options and what to do. I teach full-time at Iona College in the Masters of Marriage and Family Therapy department. And that's a little different because what we do there is I teach two classes. I teach parenting, sexuality and sex therapy, intro to marriage and family therapy, research, qualitative research, ethics in the counseling field. So I teach those classes there, but then we do live supervision, which means that we have a clinic and we have a mirror. And so if Dr. Murphy is the student therapist, he will be seeing you guys for a family session, and we're a team behind the mirror, and we can call in, we can go in, and we give him feedback and guidance. He takes a break and he goes in. So we do live supervision of beginning therapists, which is very cool.
And who are those beginning therapists? Where are they at in the
second year
career?
Of their master's? So the first year is all academic. You take coursework, and then your second year start an internship, and you see clients at our clinic. And so we do the supervision of that. We do group supervision of your site supervision because you do live or taped at your site. But when you see clients at ours, we do it live. Not always. Sometimes you don't have a team behind the mirror, but we do have a cool mirror setup. And I will say that that's a cool thing about marriage and family therapy. If anybody has no idea, people often say, well, I just want to see, like, I want to do therapy, I want to be a psychologist, but I want to work with couples and families. And that's not exactly really what we do. It's another whole vein. And one of the things with marriage and family therapy, why we do the live supervision and psychology generally doesn't, is because this guy, Salvador Mnuchin, he was sitting in a room and he got a referral for inner city, I think he was working in Chicago at the very first time, inner city kids, and therapy wasn't working. All of the analysts and the psychologists were coming in and they're like, wow, this family is just such a mess, it's not working, you know, we're trying all these things, but the kids are going back, they're committing crime, they're being thrown in prison. And so he literally went up to the wall and he punched a hole, not like with his hand, but he punched a hole into the wall and he started the first live supervision. Because what he said is, here we are working with a client in the room, and we call them clients. Psychologists generally call them patients. That's another difference. Marriage and family therapy, we call them clients. So he watched them and he found that the interaction between the family told him so much more than he would have ever found out just working with the kid, the troubled kid. And so that's how the live supervision started, is the idea that if we can watch, like live in vivo, we can watch a family or a couple warring and fighting with each other, we can right there in the action intervene, question, they're both there. We can kind of restructure, look at patterns in a way that we couldn't do when we just do therapy. So marriage and family therapy is the idea of watching people's issues that they have with other people live. We also do individual work, But individual work is always taken into account. So if I'm seeing Dr. Murphy and he's telling me he's depressed, I'm always going to be asking, what's your support system like? Who's here? Do you like your job? Do your coworkers, are they nice? Is there anyone causing stress? How's your marriage? How are your kids? I'll be asking about his other people, not just what's wrong with you that you're depressed, what's going on. So we're always taken into account, even if they're not in the room, the other people. So, okay, so what else do I do? So I teach, I supervise. I have a private practice in Litchfield on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And I specialize in marriage counseling and work with adolescents. And then I write. And I wanted to bring for you guys too, just for those of you that are looking. So everybody, well, this is a question I get, and we all, you have one of these too. This is a dissertation. So this is the first writing that you do if you want to go into the psychology field. This is a research thing. So anybody, you're welcome to look at it if you would like. And then the next thing that you do as a professional is you write journal articles. And these are dating myself because I brought old ones off my shelf. So these are the next part that we do with writing. And then you do professional magazines. This is my field that you can write. So there is writing. You don't have to, but, and then this is the most fun writing. And the reason I brought these is because sometimes people don't know that when you go into this field, you become somewhat of an expert in what you practice. So I do marriage counseling. I know about a lot of people's sex lives, a lot more than probably most of you know about, because I hear hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories about what's going on. So you become sort of an expert on one part of life or what people's interactions are. So people seek you out to try to tell them about things. So the reason I brought this is because, as you guys know, with confidentiality, we cannot really tell you a lot about what we do. We can kind of change the stories and tell you what we do and change the... But on a rare occasion, if you get permission from someone that you see, you can show a videotape or you can show live sessions or you can show really what you do. And so this is a couple that I was seeing, and I can actually show it to you because they wanted to do this and sought me out to be able to do it. And the story, and it's sort of a self-help thing to help other couples do it. So if you want to look at those, if you have any interest in writing. And then books, too. But divorce is my area of expertise, so I brought those as well. And so writing about what you know is the most important part. So I spent a lot of time writing, and I brought some of this other stuff. These two, if anybody speaks Polish or Portuguese, I can't read my own books because those are other versions, but I figured that you could flip through it and let me know what you think. So this is the other part of my life is writing. And this is the part I love the most because you reach more people than just who's in your office. I wish I had more time to write, but, and I also do blogs and podcasts for radios and stuff to try to help more people than who's in your office. And most of this stuff is like unpaid, by the way. The books you get paid for, but the other stuff that you write, journals and magazine things, is just really to be helpful. And we tend to do that in our field, right? Can I just ask real quick, is everybody interested? Are you psych majors in here? And everybody's looking at...
This is the capstone class.
Okay.
So this is their advanced seminar. Nearly everyone is finishing up with one or two exceptions. And okay. I think in general, everyone's at least interested in psychology or mental health.
Okay. So you're all looking at options of like what you want to do and what your life wants to look like. Okay, so there's all the things that I do, and you can do any, and you can, the other part is that I do have a life, really. And I have three daughters, and I am, after this, going to my daughter's softball game. So the other part about psychology is that you can teach, you can write, you can do therapy, you can supervise, but you can also, if you kind of lay it out the right way, you can have a life and you can have a family and kids and still be able to make ends meet. And that's what I like to do because I think I would be bored doing any one of these things alone. No offense to full-time here, but I would always have a practice on the side as well.
Because can we borrow those and give them back to you in a week?
Sure. Yep. Yeah.
Great.
You want everything?
Yeah, we'll take them.
This is another article on step families. This is Walmart magazine, by the way. Yeah. So I will leave whatever
we,
it is.
We love
you,
reading.
Oh, yeah, this one too.
We love reading stuff in class. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So you can kind of peek if you're interested in writing, and you can always contact me too if that's what you want to do. A lot of people go into writing, but I think they always tell you to write what you know. And when you work in this field and you start to know certain things, you can help other people to know how to work on things and fix things.
So this is a great interview because, like, I've never before had so many choices of where would I like to follow up with the next question.
Yeah, which one? Eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
But even before we go into, like, any of those other areas in a little bit more detail, maybe let's just go back. What got you interested in mental health and counseling at the beginning?
So I was probably like many of you, I was the kid in middle school and high school where my mom used to say, why is it that you always bring home all the kids that have all these problems? You know, you're always telling me so-and-so is being, you know, removed from his house, or so-and-so's dad hit him and he's all upset, or so-and-so's, you know, feeling suicidal. She would say those things to me. And at that point, I had no idea why, but I always was the helper. I wanted to fix. And of course, I had no idea how to do that in middle school. So I often would say things like, oh, you know, you should tell your mom off. And that wasn't always the best response, but I wanted to help and fix things always. So I think I was always going to choose something like this. However, I wanted to be a flight attendant. I wanted to, at one point, adopt a bunch of kids and foster and have like a bus, like a minivan bus to take them places at one point.
Like the Partridge Family.
Absolutely. That was me. I was like thinking I was going to do that. Flight attendant, I don't know, that wasn't very helpful, so I don't know why I wanted to do that. My dad was a pilot. See a lot of places, right? And help people to their seats and with drinks and make them comfortable. My dad was a pilot, and I think I just, the idea of travel was very important to me. I think that's where it came from. So then, when I graduated with my psychology degree, I was going to go into graduate school, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to do psych or mental health counseling or marriage and family. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I did an internship at a hospital and decided I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to do autopsies, actually. So I hadn't taken the courses I needed to, so I went and took the MCATs, and I scored, you know, you have your little bell curve thing, and I scored like a little bit on the lower than right in the middle average side because I hadn't taken all the math and the advanced, you know, chemistry classes like some other people who I know who have to go back and take these classes. So I didn't do that well, and I got rejected from every school, waitlisted at the University of Granada in the Caribbean. Which at the time I was told was a second-rate school and that I shouldn't go because I would never have a career here in the medical school. So I got nervous and I declined. Although at the time I was thinking, hey, live in the Caribbean, how great is that going to graduate school? So I didn't, and I literally went and signed up for my master's in marriage and family therapy. And I'm so glad I did, because had I been a doctor, I'm sure I would have loved it, but I wouldn't have been able to do all the things that I do and have a life. And how do you know that when you're 21 years old? How do you know, like, I'm going to love writing, I'm going to love being a mom? I'm not thinking about that at that point.
So where did you go undergraduate and where did you go graduate?
University of Dayton, Ohio, is where I went undergrad for psychology. And then I went to Fairfield University here for my master's in marriage and family therapy. And then the only PhD program that was really rocking at the time was Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale. It's an amazing program, hundreds. They have, I think, the only doctorate of marriage and family therapy, which is a DMFT. I did the PhD in that. So I moved to Florida, and I had a private practice and ran groups there, went to school, and then missed family, and I had my daughter down there. My daughter Ashley was 4, and I was pregnant with my second daughter, and we decided family's important, let's move back up to Connecticut. So I came back here. And I've taught at Northwestern Community College, WestCon, and Iona since. So yeah, I was a helper, and I've loved it. As soon as I started, I knew like this was going to be my calling. I didn't think I was going to be a very good therapist after the first few times, and I would tell you all that too. Therapy skills, you know, sometimes students will come up to me and say after a semester, am I going to make a good therapist? And I say to them, I don't know. And they look at me like, really? Like, you can't tell me I'm going to make a great therapist? I said, you're a great student. You love this. You want to learn. But only time will tell if you get it and if you love it and if you figure people out. Because we can't teach you everything that you need to sit in a room and be able to connect with people. We can try to tell you how you should do that, but to actually do it, not everybody can do it. So, I can tell you that my very first couple, live supervision, you know, here I am 22 years old, totally like young, inexperienced, and they tell me that my first session is going to be a couple who's maybe divorcing, this is their third marriage, and I'm thinking, oh my God. So I go in and sit down, and there's a live session. 2 minutes in, can I swear in here, is that okay? Okay. Well, just because I'm going to really give you the... So the couple starts arguing, and I'm prepared. I think I know what I'm going to do. And I'm like, so what brings you here today? And so what's been going on in your marriage? And I think I know all the questions. I'm well prepared. And she goes, listen, I see the fucking ring on your finger. Miss La La Land, Miss I'm engaged, the whole world. You don't know an effing thing about marriage. And I'm sitting there going... Like, I was, like, ready to cry. I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to suck at this. And she's like, so don't try to sit here and tell. And I was like, oh, my God. So the phone rings, thankfully. My team calls me back. And I'm like, I start bawling. I'm like, Dr. Gold, I can't. It's not the right client for me. I can't do it. I'm like bawling. He's like, no, it is the right client for you. You're going to go back in there. And I'm like, no, please, please, please. I'm like, no, I'm like crying. I can still remember it, actually, this minute. So he takes me aside outside of our consult room. And he says to me, listen, she's right. And you're going to go in there and tell her she's right. And I was like, what? And she said, you're going to go, he goes, you're going to go in there and you're going to say, you know what? You're absolutely right. I'm not on my third divorce and I am engaged and in my la-la land. And I have no idea what this must be like for you, but I really want to understand and know what this is like for you. And I want you to let me know. And I'm going to be trying my hardest to understand. And I was like, okay. That's what I said. And he's like, so you go back in there. So I went in and I was really nervous. So anyway, it was a rough start for me being able to do all that because I was young and I was challenged by my first couple of clients. About 6 months later, after that practicum was over, I was running on the beach, Campo Beach in Westport, and she was coming the other way, and we have Walkman things, like that's dating myself, but they're little earphones and a little thing with a cassette tape in it, and I was running and she was running, and I didn't see her, but she stopped and she hit my arm and she went like this to me, and I paused and I was like, oh my God, it's her. And she said, she took off hers and she said, you're the therapist we saw at Fairfield, right? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, well, you know, we're kind of making it. I don't know if we're going to make it or not. And she talked to me and she was like, well, anyway, we appreciate your help in dealing with all our battles and stuff. And she was like, so whatever, nice seeing you, and ran off. And for the first time, I was like, oh my God, so maybe I can do this. Like, maybe. So I would tell you all that you can be in, that you may be intimidated at first. It's hard to do it. You can know everything, but when you go in there, it can be scary. But you can still be a good therapist. You just don't know in the beginning.
It's so much more challenging, I think, working with a family system than just an individual. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that an individual certainly doesn't pose lots of challenges, but
yes,
there's so much to balance and juggle when you have a family together in the room. And family therapy, you know, you mentioned Salvador Mnuchin, but all the stories about Mnuchin and Virginia Satir and Bowen, I mean, they're the best stories in all of therapy. You know, they do the craziest things. Do you regard yourself as a particular theoretical orientation today in family therapy, and how does that help you when you're working with clients?
So in marriage and family therapy, we have about 10 main sort of models of therapy that we use, and they're very different than the ones that you learn in all of psychology. So you have like cognitive behavioral and these sort of things. We have, which you're probably not very aware of, but I will tell you, my master's was structural and strategic, and so my foundation is in that. But my PhD was largely in solution-focused and narrative, which are what we call postmodern theories. And so Mnuchin and everyone, they had the idea that they knew better, and they would be directive and tell you what to do to fix things. Postmodern believes that there is no reality of what you should do, that the two of us together are going to create our goals, and I'm going to support and listen and challenge what he says, but that there isn't a reality of what he has to do. We're going to co-create it in our time together. And so I'm much more postmodern. I never go in thinking I know what I'm going to tell someone to do. I figure, let's talk, I'm going to listen, I'm going to challenge, and then together we're going to create what the problem is and what needs to be done. So solution focus is my favorite model, and that is because the past is only as important as it influences the current situation or the future. So I don't spend a lot of time on the past. It's much more about, so what would it look like to have it go differently? You know, when is the time when it did go differently? What do you think needs to change to have it be like that? I'm much more about, how do we get to where you want, rather than spending a lot of time on problem talk. Because problem talk is important to know what the problem is, but then people want to fix it. They want it to be different. So that would be my model of choice.
Great. One of my favorite Mnuchin stories, and this may just be because I have a 28-year-old son living with me at the moment while he finishes his graduate degree, but he's seeing a family with a schizophrenic young adult son, and he tells the couple, look, I want you to move out of the house. Don't tell the son you're leaving. Check into a hotel, and I want you to stay there for the next 3 weeks, and we'll see what happens. I was like, wow. You know, it's like only Mnuchin would try something like that. Would you mind... one of the things that we can do is swap chairs so you can sort of see the rest of the class.
Oh,
would you mind?
Sure.
This is a little bit family therapy-ish, actually, because we
structural.
Do find things like
Move
switch
chairs.
Chairs and try and see things from the other person's point
we
of
do.
View, right?
So if mom is siding with the child, we will actually say, hey, mom, do you mind sitting over here with dad? And come here, son, sit over here. We'll actually move people, and we notice where people sit. It's why I joke with some of you who've been in class about the people sitting in the front row, for example. Well, you all sit in the front row. You don't sit in the front, do you?
I'm
no,
like
middle.
I'm in the midsection. Yeah. I sat in the front today.
Only because you were late and you couldn't get a seat? Because I'd be interpreting your choice. Nailed. She's like, yeah,
I was
that
late
was true.
By 1 minute.
See, but I notice these things because I'm a structural therapist. I'm watching where people sit when they sit and all of that, yes.
One of the areas that you teach an honors course here that's very popular is the psychology of sex.
It's giving me such a headache, by the way. 7 pages of emails on
okay.
that. But anyway,
so,
sorry. Yeah.
So at Iona, you teach a course in that, right?
Yes.
Sex therapy.
Yep.
So is that, do you see that as a sort of a whole different field, or is that a subfield of marriage and family counseling? And what
right.
does it take to really be comfortable? Because that seems to be still, even in 2016, like the one sort of
awkward.
Taboo area in
yes.
in society.
Yes. So it's human sexuality. We teach you in school the sexual response cycle, like the basics on sex.
Masters and Johns.
Absolutely, all of that stuff. And I do cover that in the sexuality class. However, teenagers come in, and I realize from my adolescent psych class that they know so little about the most important things, like a woman's menstrual cycle and when the most fertile times are. And I usually, any of you who have been in my class, you know, I usually call up a male and a female to kind of like just track and show, you know, what times are that are more fertile and these sort of things and the changes that happen in bodies. And guys and girls struggle with that. They're like, I don't know, maybe she's fertile here. Like, so that lack of knowledge and understanding about your own bodies and the repercussions that could come from that. So I think it's really important to not only have just understanding of, you know, bodies and sexuality, but the more important things. So, for example, I teach on post-abortion syndrome. Lots of young women and men in adolescence and young adulthood have that choice of getting pregnant, an unwanted pregnancy, and having to grapple with being a teenage parent, which is often covered, having an abortion, which is often not covered. But it's something that happens to a lot of teens. So when you're a marriage and family therapist, you need to become a lot more comfortable with talking about everything sexual, even stuff that you don't do, you don't know about, and makes you feel uncomfortable. Because when you're in a room with someone, they may say things to you that make you squirm or crawl because of your own history. And so in the sex therapy class, my first assignment is to pick something, a word, a term, whatever, that makes you just uncomfortable, whether you know why or not, whether it's like an S&M kind of thing, a certain word of a body part, or something that makes you feel something, and to kind of explore what's up with that, why. And it's so interesting what comes from those papers. And one of my favorite stories is that even, I'm a pretty seasoned clinician, but I was seeing these two men, they were a homosexual couple, big age difference, and the first thing they were doing is fighting for like 5 minutes in the session about one of them being caught with a glory hole.
Uh-oh.
I didn't know what that was. After teaching this, after all this time, I did not know what a glory hole was. And if you all want to know, you can go Google it and look it up.
Well, the guys know just because of male pornography, I think.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So they're going on and on. Now, the other thing about marriage and family therapy is that content isn't important. So I only really needed them to define what a glory hole was if I felt like knowing it would have been really important to me. So I initially started with the whole idea of, so what is it about this? Hoping they'll tell me what it was.
Clue, right?
And at some point, one of them looks at me and he goes, "You don't know what a glory hole is, do you?" And I said, "Truth be told, I do not." And he goes, "Honey, you do not watch enough porn." And I was like, right then I knew that it was, you know, something. So I went home and Googled it later. But so the point being, if I had been a newer therapist, I knew how to roll with that and not be terribly, there's things that we don't know. And so part of it is the education, but every person, for the most part, will have a sexual experience in their life. They may be married, they may date, they may have, you know, an unwanted, there's all these things may happen to every one of you. And the fact that we have so little education on it, I think is, it's sad. So yes, I think it's important that you know about exploring the awkward topics, and everybody in the class always becomes really close, in the graduate one for sure, because they're smaller classes. They become so close afterwards because they're talking about their views on everything. And we watch a lot of videos on different things. And then of course, when a couple comes in, we talk about all the different sex styles and sex positions, and one of the big topics that I spend some time is disability in sex. You know, a lot of people don't realize, or they assume that people that have a physical disability or a cognitive disability don't have sex. And they do and they can. So you can help them to have a sex life, even if they're completely disabled, even if they're completely paralyzed. But people don't know this, and they're uncomfortable to ask. And it's not like you're going to walk up to someone and say, "So, you're in a wheelchair, can you have sex?" It's not the kind of thing that people do. So knowing about it enables you to help someone else to be able to see. Sex surrogacy, we talk about. Sex therapy, which I'm not a certified sex therapist, but that's a separate degree that you can hold. But when you work with couples, you generally hear about sex. So it's important to have a background in sex to work with couples, in my opinion.
The class will maybe like this story, but I ran into the client that you saw in the video, Stephanie, a few years ago, and I said, "Oh, how are you doing?" She said, "Oh, I'm in the field now." I'm, you know. I said, "What are you working on?" She goes, I've just published a picture book on sexual positions for people with disabilities.
Oh, really?
And she must have seen, I looked a little shocked, and she's like, and she'd broken her leg in an athletic accident and was in a, you know, full cast for like, you know, 3 months. And she said that triggered her interest in like, how do you have sex when things are not working properly?
She put her in touch with me. I'd love to have her come speak to my class about it. Because I don't have a picture book. That would add another layer to it, for sure.
I didn't ask her to sign a copy.
But you have a copy.
Looking back, what do you think is the one thing maybe from graduate school, and then the one thing maybe since you graduated that have really helped you with your career to be successful? I know that's a sort of broad question, but what do you think was a couple of important influences on you?
I think workshop or people or professors or teachers that you have are so important, and you should utilize them. I make a practice when we're required to get these CEUs every year, which are continuing education units. You probably don't with practice, but you might.
You do. For my Connecticut license.
Okay. So we have to go to trainings. And if I love the training and really the person resonates with me and I really like the person, I generally walk up and introduce myself and say, I love your work. Is there any way we could talk or have breakfast or whatever I like? And they're usually looking at me kind of like, oh, aren't you awfully forward? But I love it because I can, you know, pick their brain and ask things. And I've co-authored books and articles. And David Treadway actually is a really great clinician in Boston. I met him 2 years ago. I went up to him afterwards, and now they've invited me to Harvard Medical School to do some sex and marriage kind of stuff. So the connections with people in our field, like you were saying, is very isolating. So when you meet a professor whose story, whose life, whose work you like, I would so encourage you, or someone who you attend a workshop, or someone who writes a book that you love. Actually, most of us, people think like if someone writes a book, there's some big author who's untouchable. Stephen King, yes, maybe. But for the rest of us who write books, we're so touchable. Like, really, we're right here. So you could easily email, you know, someone. You email Dr. Murphy if you didn't know him and just say, hey, I really like your book.
I get him all the time.
Yeah, there you go. See? So you can make these connections and get people to help and support you and find out where they went to school, what they learned. So I would say that is the people, either coworkers, professors that I've had, speakers. And then I would also say... to figure out what's important to you is important, because obviously nobody goes to get a PhD if they don't think they're going to be a career person. But I found out after I had my career going that I didn't want to just be like a career woman. Like, it was much more important to be a mom. I was fortunate that my field helped me to be able to be a mother and have a life and write, but I didn't know that. I thought I was just going to be like researching and teaching. And so I think the earlier that you can try to say, are other things important to me, and how am I going to have a job that fits that, is really important. Because you're not going to be happy, like doing pure clinical work, for example. If you just work 8-hour days, my first job out of my master's program, I did work 8 hours a day, and I worked late. I worked like 12 to 8 at night. And after a while, I start to dread those last couple clients coming in. I would be like, oh my God, I'm starving. I can't eat. I've been booked solid. This person is in crisis. And I would start to feel like kind of burned out. And I thought, wow, like, that's terrible. I'm this helper, and I'm feeling like I'm dreading. I'm hoping my 8 o'clock cancels or my 7 o'clock cancels. So I think knowing what's important to you. For me, working several different types of jobs makes, and I really truly mean this, I love my life and my jobs fully, but I'm not sure whether that would be true if I were straight academia, if I were straight private practice, if I were straight writing. So if you can figure out the things that you love in your life, try to put them together in a way that makes you happy. Because you won't love this work if you're not happy.
How do you advertise your private practice?
I don't. Because I've been there so long that I have so many referral sources. But for the rest of you who are getting started, I can definitely give you ideas. But I actually don't. It's only word of mouth that you can find me. But that's rare. It's only because I only do that part-time and I just don't have enough hours. So I actually dread when someone says, oh my goodness, you work up there. That's wonderful. Give me your card so I can refer. And I go, no, please don't. Please don't, because I have enough. Like, I don't want anybody else. So if anybody goes in the field and you transfer up that way, I could certainly throw you some referrals. But in terms of advertising, the best things to do are Psychology Today or Psychotherapy Networker to advertise in. And they have a database and everything. But my best advice is, when you get out of school, work at an agency and work it so that you get to know that area so well. So if you work in Danbury, get to know all the DCF workers, all the attorneys, especially the family law attorneys, the family attorneys or the divorce attorneys, the schools, all the guidance counselors, make the extra effort to call and be in touch. Because a few years down the line, if you go into private practice, they will all know you, they'll think you're good, and they'll refer to you. Insurance panels will never get you many. It's great to be in insurance panels, which I am, but you get a few calls a year from people like Anthem sending you somebody. People don't choose often by going to their card. They ask people, who's a good therapist? Do you have anybody? They tell them, they call you. If you take Anthem, you can take them. So much better to work the area than to think you're going to sit in your private practice and get calls all day from insurance companies. It doesn't work that way.
Great.
Yeah.
Questions from the class? Who would like to ask Lisa something?
I remember the sample you gave for like,
glory hole, yeah.
Yeah, and you trying to probe them by asking all the questions, trying to like find out what it was.
Yes.
Do you often do that with your clients, or sometimes do you like explicitly ask them what it is?
Yes, sometimes I'll be like, what's a glory hole? Yeah, absolutely. But that comes more with comfort. I think when we first start out, I was like this, I'm sure you were like this too. When you first start and you just have your degree and you're not sure that you totally know what to do, you tend to really want to act like you know what you're doing, and you're afraid of saying, gee, I don't know what to do here, or, you know, I'm thinking that maybe you guys aren't ready. You're sort of uncomfortable and embarrassed about not knowing something. You want to be the expert in everything. And in time, you realize that we all have limitations, and I'll be the first one to say, you know. But the reason I didn't ask about that glory hole is because it was content. It wasn't. That's like me asking, what color shoes were you wearing when you were telling that he had your shoes? There's a fine line between getting details that I want to know about versus is it important to know? That ended up being important to know, because what it is that someone services someone anonymously, usually, you know, oral sex, through a hole in the wall. Well, that's kind of important to know, because that's sort of, is that cheating? Is it infidelity? Is it, you know, is it safe being anonymous sex? So it was important for me to know, and I probably would have asked, but I was hoping that it would just sort of, that I'd get it when I tell their story.
That's such a great point, because I think back to all the years when I was at the Olympic Training Center, and we had a lot of young graduate students that were coming and training in a very high-pressure environment. And that was like the one theme that would always, always come up in supervision, was that they were trying to appear so confident when they go and work with the team, you know, and then I could see they were struggling, you know, the person would be talking about the infield fly rule and the double steal, and they'd be like, they didn't know baseball perhaps, you know, and I just had to keep telling all of them, it was every year, you know, the new group, just relax and ask the person, look, I have no clue what you're talking about, because it's also a great way of bonding, like the client loves to tell about their own life, and so they know, as you said with that very first story, I'm interested, I want to hear, I want to get
tell me
inside
about it.
Your life.
Yeah,
that's a great
they're the expert.
Connection.
And who doesn't want to like be told, you're an expert, tell me. They love that. Right. They don't get intimidated that you don't know, they're actually happy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like as far as, you know, you said that you had children and you had one when you were in your graduate degree program, mm-hmm. how did your children affect your schooling and your career? And how, like, what would you tell someone that was having children?
That's a great question.
To, like, make it come together so they could still be career-driven and successful, but maybe, you know, also a good mom.
Yes. So, it's a great, great question. I didn't know going in what the best plan would be, and I was 6 months pregnant with Ashley, 7 months pregnant when I started my PhD program. And I didn't tell anybody because I wasn't really even showing it 6 months. I mean, you know, I was just I wasn't very big with her. So maybe September or so after I started my PhD program, I went to one of my professors and I said, you know, I just thought I'm due December 11th. And I just thought I should tell you that, like, I'm pregnant and expecting my first child. And they were like, what? They're like, no one's ever had their first child, like, in during their doctoral program. And I was like, because I'd gone in so like blindly, like just, oh, this is great, I'm having a baby, I'm doing this and that, whatever. And they're like, wow, how are you going to do this? And all of a sudden I was like, I guess I'm just going to like keep going and taking classes. And they were like, oh my gosh. And they made me feel anxious about it, but it was the best thing I ever did because I gave birth to her on December 22nd. It was late, it was during my break. I almost dropped out of the program because I was so emotional, loved her so much. I was like, I don't want to be a career woman anymore, I don't want to go back. But my family said, just, you know, go and do it. And you know, so we had my husband's grandmother at the time watched her just 2 days a week when I went to classes. It's the best thing I did because getting your doctorate when you have a baby, the baby sleeps a lot. you can nap with the baby, and then when the baby's sleeping later, do your dissertation. Stay up late and sleep in when she naps in the morning. I don't know that I would do it now, to be honest, or even the last 10 years, because I'm older and I'm more tired, and the kids need things. So I would tell you, if at all possible, if you want to do your graduate work, do it now. Just motor through and do it now, because life happens to you whether you want it to or not, and it can make things complicated and make it harder. So that would be my recommendation. In terms of the kids, I worked very little when they were little. I adjuncted here a couple night classes way back, two nights a week, and I had a small private practice with like maybe six people in it on Saturdays, because that way my husband was home with the kids, and that's all I did. And I wrote on my own time. I wrote like one book and one article. Start like that. And that's what's good about our field, is you can do it. You can do per diem work. You can go get paid $40 or $45 an hour to see five or six clients a week. So you're in it, you're building your name for an agency. You can do supervision of, you know, students, especially in MFT. We have this status called AMFT Approved Supervisor. In Connecticut, you need post-grad hours supervised by someone. And that usually gets you $50 to $100 an hour to supervise someone's supervision. So you can work part-time, make a little money, and stay in the field. The parent education classes that I have taught, 6 hours on Sundays. I did that. Did I want to work on Sunday for 6 hours? Not really. But it was a way to make $50 an hour working 6 hours and make a little income and be in the field while my kids were little. So you do kind of what you have to do, but it's a great question. I think, but our field allows for you to have a life. It really does, if you're smart about what you do. And then I think you hear the jokes about, it's like, oh, and you have two. Oh, your poor children having two psychologists for parents. I hear this. I only have one, but your kids have two. Yes, you hear the jokes. And I have to say, I could see how that could happen with some people, but I think one of the first things they taught us in graduate school is you can't do therapy in your own family. As much as family members want to come, I am still a mother with my daughter, my daughters. I am a mother. I am not a therapist. I may be therapeutic in how I talk to her or talk about things, but I am not her therapist. There are times where I get so frustrated and I think, oh my God, I'm not being a therapist. I'm getting personally frustrated or upset or worried about something. So I think knowing that, use your therapeutic tools, absolutely. I don't freak out. I think before I speak. I listen, I do things like that that are helpful, but I don't try to be a therapist in my own family. And I think with kids, sometimes that can be, you know, the problem. But I feel like my kids benefited for the most part, except about the sex part. When they're growing up, they had a little bit of a different sex talk than many of your parents did with them. I would say things like, well, you know, your body is this. And when people communicate, and they'd be like, like rolling their eyes, like, seriously, we have to have this talk again? With that exception, I don't know that, and you guys would know, you would know. Does she complain much about having a mother as a therapist?
I don't think so.
Not too much? Well, she went in and got her degree in psychology, so she couldn't have hated it that much, right? But that's a tricky thing. It's a good question.
Great questions. Well, let's thank Dr. Reynolds for coming in and being our interviewer today.
And now we're going to do a